Thank you very much for coming. I want to thank the Thornhill Community Shul for hosting the program this evening. I am Mordechai Torchiner. I am the Rosh Beit Midrash at the Yeshiva University Torah Mitzvah Beit Midrash Zichron Dov, and I will be the moderator for this evening. I also want to make sure to thank Mrs. Shoshana Newman, programmer for the Beit Midrash, for her work in setting up the program, and to note that the evening's lecture is generously sponsored in memory of Michal Mordechai Ben Yisrael. May his memory be a blessing to his family and all the Jewish people. Stuart Haber, Executive Director, National Director, excuse me, University of Canada, is there in the back, and he has taken upon himself the responsibility of passing around the sign-in sheet. Thank you very much. And I will also note that next month there will be a Shabbaton from Yeshiva University throughout Toronto with quite a few speakers. There are flyers out there in the lobby. They look like this. And that will be Shabbos, March 9th and 10th, the Shabbos right after Purim. So our topic tonight is on, off, and after the Derech. As I noted in the email that went out advertising it today, when religion and family collide. Since there have been Jews, there has been emphasis upon a derech, a path, and Jewish continuity. How do we pass on our values, our beliefs, our ideas to the next generation? So that back in the very beginning of our story, the time of Avraham, Hashem says, God says, I am selecting Avraham because he will pass the derech. He will pass the path onto our children. A path of tzedek u'mishpat, righteousness and justice. We are told in the Torah of Halachta Bidrachav, you shall walk in Hashem's derech, you shall follow Hashem's path. And since there have been Jews, there have been challenges in passing that derech on to our children. So that Avraham and Sarah find themselves raising Yitzchak, but they also find Yishmael living in the house, and Yishmael has a decidedly different idea about how to pursue life. He is described biblically as a para adam, a wild man. Yitzchak and Rivka, Isaac and Rebekah, a man and a woman who certainly have a shared vision, raise one son, Yaakov, and his twin, Esav. And they have wildly different ideas about what it means, what a derech should be, how one should live life. Moshe Rabbeinu, our great teacher, has a son by the name of Gershom, and we are told in the Medrash that Gershom and his descendants go off into Avodah Zarah, into idolatry. This is at once a very difficult thing for us to absorb and to understand, and on the other hand, it's very logical. Because Judaism as a system of belief is not necessarily something that can be taught. It requires that each individual experience it uniquely. Over 2,000 years ago, a man by the name of Yehoshua ben Gamla perceived this and understood it, and he said, you know, having parents teach their children does not always work out. We need a system of Jewish schools to take it on, and he created that first system of communal Jewish education. We see it in the Torah itself. The Torah describes the mitzvah of telling our children about our departure from Egypt. And it says, V'igadata levincha, you shall tell your children. And it says it four different times in four different ways, from which we understand that there are many different types of children, and our derech, our path, has to be communicated to them in different ways. So we try our best with our children. And perhaps Avraham's attempts to bring his son Yishmael in line are a good example of that, maybe even the best example. Avraham turns to God and he says, when he's told there's going to be another son and he will be Yitzchak and he will be the true heir to the line, Avraham turns to God and he says, Lu Yishmael yichye lefanecha. I'd be very happy if Yishmael would turn out all right. And Avraham does his best to see that through, so that when Avraham receives the mitzvah of bris milah, of circumcision, he first gives one to his son Yishmael before taking care of his own. When guests come to Avraham's tent, Avraham turns to his son Yishmael and he says, you take care of feeding them. And the Medrash comments, it's in order to train him in the mitzvah. Avraham does not give up hope on his son Yishmael. He wants to see him follow that path. As a matter of fact, the Medrash even records that after Yishmael had been kicked out of the house at divine command, Avraham still went after him to try to bring him back, to try to bring him on a proper path. And so we have two big questions tonight. One, what can parents do to promote their derech, their path? And number two, what can parents do to keep their families together and strong while dealing with these issues? The structure for the evening is that I'm going to first introduce our two esteemed panelists. After that, they will each have an opportunity to make it an opening presentation. Following that, we will go into at least one scenario for them to discuss, and then turn it over to question and answer, opportunity for people to ask questions for us to discuss. I would ask that questions please be kept somewhat brief and global, general, rather than about specific personal situations. Our two panelists, first of all, Rabbi Dr. Nassan Westreich. Dr. Westreich, a child and adolescent psychiatrist, is an assistant professor at the University of Toronto Medical School. He's on staff at Sunnybrook Health Sciences Center, where he co-directs the inpatient adolescent regional unit and teaches both medical students and residents. Dr. Westreich's academic interests are medical education, community education, and establishing programs that destigmatize mental illness. Dr. Westreich has been a consultant for a series of national commercials aimed to destigmatize mental illness. Dr. Westreich has clinical interest in first episode psychosis, dual diagnosis, and neurologically challenged youth, and is directing the Adolescent Acquired Brain Injury Program at Sunnybrook's renowned Trauma Center. There are many, many more credentials I could list here, but I will skip to the last two. He holds a master's degree in education from Loyola, rabbinical ordination from Ne'er Israel Rabbinical College of Baltimore, and Dr. Westreich served as director of NCSY for 10 years prior to his medical education and started numerous youth initiatives, including the first Jewish camp in the Ukraine. Dr. Westreich, thank you for joining us. And Rabbi Avram Rothman is the founding rabbi of the Thornhill Community Shul, right here. Previously, he founded Or Sameach of Greater Toronto, together with Rabbi Uziel Malevsky Zatzal, Rabbi Mordechai Becher Yevod Alechaim, and Rabbi Eliezer Breidowitz. Rabbi Rothman has been a regular lecturer for Arachim, is a noted writer, holds the Sherman Award for Outstanding Jewish Professional Leadership by the Council of Jewish Federations. He was ordained by Rav Ruderman of Ne'er Israel Rabbinical College in Baltimore, holds a Master's of Science in Guidance and Counseling from Johns Hopkins University, and a PhD. I didn't know that. And a PhD in Comparative Literature from the Palmer School of Clark University in Massachusetts. Rabbi Rothman was a rabbi in Boulder, Colorado, the executive director of the Hillel Council of Colorado, and associate executive director of the Worcester Jewish Federation. He holds registration and certification in marriage counseling and is a member of the Rabbinical Council of America and the Vada Rabbanim of Toronto. And I will ask Rabbi Rothman, as the Mara D'Astra, to please present his opening remarks first.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Torshiner. The Baal Tshuva movement of the 60s and the 70s was an anomaly. I remember one of my Rabbanim telling me that when he was a boy, and he spent time in Yerushalayim before the state, there was one Baal Tshuva in the entire city, and everyone knew who he was. Following the 67 war in Israel, there was an amazing change in the Jewish world, and Baalei Tshuva were being attracted with little effort on the part of the already observant community. 50 years later, we now find ourselves with another anomaly, in that the Torah community is finding itself with increased numbers, and that virtually every yeshiva, Beis Yaakov, day school, shul, and community organization has at least a significant minority of Baalei Tshuva families, as can easily be evidenced in Toronto and even more so here in Thornhill. The children and grandchildren of Baalei Tshuvos in this area very well may be the majority. The increase of numbers and the sudden diversity of the observant community has brought with it a number of unique problems, such that have not been seen to this extent in modern Jewish history. Among the children and grandchildren of the Baalei Tshuva, those people who themselves rebelled against the secular lifestyle that they were raised in, there are children who, for reasons we will discuss this evening, have chosen to not follow in the path of their Baalei Tshuva families. Now, We find people who once struggled to become observant, who changed their lives, being faced now with offspring, who assume the same struggle, but this time a struggle to not necessarily follow the same path as their parents or grandparents. This is an issue that I deal with almost daily, be it in my leading a community of primarily Balei Tshuva or in my personal life. It is a problem that faces us all. If it is not found in every home, it is certainly found on every block. And why is that? Some say it is due to the amazing pressure of the culture and the environment that we live in. The advent of the internet, the pervasiveness of popular culture, the loosening of morality and censorship in media, culture's pressure to not allow legislation of moral issues, have all made it exceedingly difficult to raise a child or even to keep oneself centered on the life of Torah, of family, and of the discipline found in the Torah lifestyle. Others claim that the increase of special needs, especially those in areas of learning, and the lack of services for those children create a true barrier, pushing away those children who are somewhat square pegs pushed into round holes. In a culture such as ours that is very academic and also seeks a level of conformity, it is easy to see a child who does not excel in his or her studies quickly become bruised in their self-esteem and seek other, perhaps less fortunate avenues to excel at. Finally, just naming a few of the common responses one hears, there are those who believe that some children just are not interested, they're not inspired, they're perhaps even not willing to do and act in accordance with the Torah lifestyle for no more reason than their parents or grandparents had when they chose to discard the secular lifestyle and grasp a Torah way of life. Whatever the reason, whatever the cause, the results are that wonderful, caring parents who themselves were moser nefesh to become observant are now seeing their children and others leave the path that they fought so valiantly to be a part of. Compounding this, for many of those children, there may be little or no support system for them when they stray from the path, and they may find themselves associating with and involved with parts of the community that are not only not observant, but more so sometimes involved in criminal or harmful activities and lifestyles. Our hope this evening is to assist those among us in being better prepared if or when such a thing happens to a family member or a neighbor. I do not believe that there's any single answer, and I don't believe that there's a magic bullet that we can use to, quote, save them. It is important to note that the issue of guilt and responsibility needs to be addressed. Some see themselves as guilty, not being around enough, not being the best role model. Others deflect responsibility and blame the system, the community, the schools, the peer pressure. I believe that we need to understand that there are many reasons and many causes for children to leave the path. Certainly the family, the community, the schools, and the leaders all bear some responsibility. Each case, though, is different, and each case is unique. We certainly would need to look within ourselves to see the extent of responsibility that we may bear. However, we also need to understand that our children have free will. They have the ability to choose how they want to live, and ultimately, in most cases, the responsibility for their choices remains solely with them. Hashem gives us these wonderful neshamos to nurture and to develop. We do our best. We succeed in some ways, and we fail in others. We strive to be the best and do the best that we can But in the end, it's not our choice, and it's not our decision. Hopefully tonight will be an introduction to some ways that we can be more effective. But it's only the start. Yet, starting on the way is light years ahead of not taking that first step at all. We may not be able to answer all of the questions, but we will certainly not run away from them either. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Rothman. And now, Rabbi Dr. Westreich.
Rabbi Rothman reminded me that the last time we were on a panel together was around 35 years ago. We were both Talmidim in Baltimore, and WBAL, a television station, was running a program about Passover, and they took around 7 or 8 bachurim from the yeshiva and asked us to be part of that panel. And I remember how nervous I was when I came my turn to explain the matzah. I said, "This is matzah, which is made of bread and water." So I felt terrible that evening when I misled a lot of Jews who actually woke up at 5:30 in the morning to watch that in WBAL. So I hope this evening my remarks might be a bit controversial, but I hope I'm not going to mislead any of you. I'd like to start with my opening remarks by telling you about an episode. David Green, I think many of you know, I went to his son's wedding several years ago. And I did one of those 48-hour gigs where you fly over and then you come back. And I was resting quite comfortably in my seat in El Al. And I was sound asleep. And I got that tap on the shoulder that I think every doctor doesn't want to get, especially if you're a psychiatrist. And the tap was, "Dr. Westreich, we need you." And I was like, "For what?" And they said, "Well, someone's dying in the back of the plane." So I said, "Well, do you have a real doctor here?" And he says, "No, you're it. The psychiatrist is it." So I run, and the sort of said, we need to know if we have to land in Ireland, because this patient is dying. So they hand me a stethoscope. I had seen one of those things before. And I run to the back of the plane, and there's around 30 or 40 people around this, I'll call her patient, and she's screaming, "I'm dying, I'm dying," which is always a good sign, by the way. Anyway, as I get closer, I see that she seems to be somewhat of a younger girl. She's screaming, "I'm dying, I'm dying." And the assistant pilot, hopefully not the pilot, the assistant pilot, the stewardess, there are around 30 or 40 people are gathered around her. And I took her pulse. I figured, someone says they're going to die, see if they're alive. I took her pulse. And she had a pulse. And then I said, "Are you on any medications?" She said, "Yes." I said, "What are you taking?" She says, "I'm taking Prozac." I said, "Oh, that's an antidepressant." They said, "Oh, everybody, shalom. You got the right doctor." I said, "Are you taking anything else?" She says, "I'm taking Ativan, lorazepam." Which is no one knows here, of course. It's a sedative, So I understood. She was, and she was a kid, it was a birthright. And she starts to tell me her story that she forgot her meds and she hadn't taken the Ativan in 3 days. So she was in withdrawal. So what's the treatment for the withdrawal? You treat them with more Ativan. So I got up because I wanted to know if they had to land the plane. I said, "Does anybody here have lorazepam, temazepam, or clonazepam?" And 150 people stood up and they got their medications out of their purses. I tell you this story as a matter of introduction because I think with all due respect, I'm going to be a little controversial tonight, I think with all due respect, inadvertently, I think that the community, I speak as an insider and as an outsider, those of us who worked in the Baal Teshuva segment, inadvertently have made an error, I think, which is that there's an inadvertent promise that if you become part of the community, it's going to be nirvana. This is going to answer all of your questions. And I came across something interesting from the Baal Sefer Ikrim, who I think E.B. Rottenberg actually did a song about this. But he refers to, in explaining in dealing with loss and death, he explains the parable of twins who are being held within the mother's womb. and how there is a struggle, and the first child emerges from the womb, and he imagines for a moment, if you could, the psychology of the child left behind. The child left behind, who was in the warmth and in the comfort of his mother's womb, must feel sorry for his brother. That's if they didn't have sibling rivalry already. But must feel sorry for him that he has to leave this kind of perfect environment that becomes part of the world. And St. Raygram uses this as an example, as a parable to refer to when there's a loss, when there's a death, Chas v'Shalom, that how we have to understand it, that we have this kind of misperception of what is taking place, but really they're going on to another place, to a better place. But I have a problem with the actual mashal itself, because the mashal itself seems to imply, that here you are in this kind of perfect environment and perfect place, and then you emerge into the world, and 150 people stood up, and were giving lorazepam, clonazepam, and temazepams. It's not idealistic, the world. It's full of stress and strain and conflict and difficulty and angst. So what was the Sefer Akron saying? What's the mushel? So the way I understand it is that the angst and the pain and the struggle of life, the meaning of life is its validity, if I can borrow from Viktor Frankl. That what is so wonderful about our lives and what is so intriguing about our lives is not a kind of perfection and a kind of perfect environment, but it's the fact that we operate and have to choose and make our bechira, and that life is imperfect, and we have to live in an imperfect world, and we have to make difficult decisions, which will require conviction and disappointment and the like, and that is our mission. Now, I reflect on this in my opening statements, because I think inadvertently, and you can correct me if you think I'm wrong, because the rabbis have a job to do. I mean, there was one particular family that came to me who said, I think that we should have a class action suit against Or Samach and Eshet Torah. I said, why? He said, well, I was raising my family on Bayview. I was making $160,000 a year. I had 1.0 children. And then I move into the community. I can't afford a house. I have 6 children, and I have a tuition, which is $150,000. And life wasn't as tranquil as I thought it would be. Now, he kind of said that in jest, but in reality, I think if we're all honest about it, for those who are returning to the community, who have returned to the community, it's not always smooth sailing. And this is not a critique, truly, okay, about the meaning or the value of Torah nor its legitimacy, but in terms of integrating into the community and then raising your children, it is fraught with challenges. And that it's not always so perfect. And perhaps, even under certain circumstances, perhaps it even becomes even more, if I could be provocative enough, it becomes even more challenging when you adopt an observant lifestyle and you have older children. So I think that an open and fair discussion this evening about what the issues are and how to understand it from a religious perspective, which is incredibly important, but also from a psychological perspective, I think is a welcome forum. So I look forward to our discussion this evening.
Thank you very much. I think rather than continue to shuffle places, maybe we'll allow you to sit for the these scenarios. So we're going to try our first scenario and see how this one goes. A couple, after 20 years of marriage, decide to become observant fairly rapidly. They have 3 children, a son age 17, a daughter age 15, and a son age 10. They put their children into observant Orthodox private schools with tutors to help them catch up, and the kids all react differently. The 10-year-old takes to the change very easily. The 15-year-old has some bumps, but after some effort, she seems to acclimate well. The oldest, 17, is unwilling to switch schools, friends, or lifestyle. He's somewhat willing to live within the home in an Orthodox lifestyle, but in his personal life, school, and life goals, he's not interested, and is occasionally defiant. How should the parents help their 17-year-old in terms of his own situation and his impact on the family? Robert Rothman.
Okay, I get to be first because I wrote it. I think the first general rule that I'd like to say, which applies in this case, and I think in every case, is that the most important thing and the hardest thing for a parent is to remember that their child is their child. And they love their child, and their child is multifaceted. And their religious observance may cover everything that they do, but the child is bigger than just that.
And then while this child, in this case, is choosing to not adopt the lifestyle of his parents, because he's at that age, and probably he's got an enormous world in front of him, and all types of things that are attracting him, but nevertheless, the parents, in this case, and I think in every case, need to remember that the child is theirs. And that ultimately, if they keep a strong, positive relationship with that child, if he chooses to become a part of the community or he does not choose to become a part of the community at this time, we can be assured of the following. That if they do not keep a positive relationship with the child, he will not choose to come back. Because in this case, the child was not originally observant. But in my experience, I don't think I have ever come across a child who left Judaism, left Torah, life of Torah, because they disproved it. They left it for any other numerous reasons that have to do with anything but the philosophy of is Judaism, is Torah true? And therefore, if we want them to come back or we want them to assume this lifestyle, it's the relationship that we have with them and that we build with them that is ultimately going to be the catalyst that brings them back. Because just as we know that many of us who turned and became observant, very few of us actually did so at first, certainly, because of the philosophy of Torah, that we proved it was correct to ourselves. But there was the peers and the life and the people and the family that attracted us. And so, too, we have to remember that in relationship to these children. And so in this case with this child, who is just showing absolutely no interest, the fact is that as he matures and as his life changes, if we keep that positive relationship with the child and we keep the door open, so then as he matures, he very well may turn back towards this life. But if we don't keep it, then all of his emotions will be very, very negative. And that whatever thoughts he may have to turn back to the life that his parents have entered as he gets older will be washed away by the deep-seated feelings and emotions that he has that have become so negative. That's sort of in a general sense. Perhaps, Dr. Westright, you'd like to speak more specifically.
I think this is probably, you probably see this scenario, you know, fairly often, and I think I see it from a different side. I'll see the 17-year-old. I want to throw a question out to the audience, actually. I mean, this is based on some studies. Do you think that there are more children who are, so to speak, going off the derech, who are found amongst Baalei Teshuva families, in contrast to those who have been raised as from Orthodox Jews who are not Baalei Teshuva? So are there more children going off the derech from Baalei Teshuva families or not? Can I see a raise of hands? How many think that there are more kids who are going off the derech if their parents are Baalei Teshuva? Okay, and how many feel that that's not a true statement? Okay. Well, I guess it depends on the literature that you look at. Pelkowitz and Kahn did a study, and it was actually presented recently at the Age Up convention, and they actually found that there was no difference. There were no differences in terms of the percentage of children who leave the faith, regardless of whether they come from Baalei Teshuva families or from Orthodox families. Now, there was a study done around 2 years ago in Yerushalayim, actually by the municipality. I don't know if you're aware of this, but in Yerushalayim today, there is a tremendous problem of Haredi youth who are on the streets. It is a tremendous problem that the city is dealing with, and it's an economic problem, it's a crime problem, it's a real, real phenomenon. And the municipality actually did a study, and they found that amongst the risk factors for children going off the derech, and this is amongst Haredi youth in Yerushalayim, which I think is a very particular population, they actually found that it was a risk factor. That if the child was from the home of Bali Tshuva, it was one of the risk factors. Again, I can't analyze the data to tell you the absolute percentage, and also you have to bear in mind that particular population. But in the North American study by Polkowitz and Kahn, there is no difference whatsoever. And they went at it and as a proper, with proper methodology, looking at the epidemiology, there is no difference in children going off the derech who are coming from Orthodox homes, meaning non-Bali Tshuva homes, versus Bali Tshuva homes. Now, what Palkowitz and Kahn, and I kind of thought about this in my own kind of way, when I reviewed the article, they actually looked at three factors that they thought were incredibly important in terms of a child's adherence to an observant lifestyle. Two of them are for the broader community, and one is in Dodge's specific struggle for the Bali Tshuva community. They looked at, first of all, the sense of the family. Is this what they call a chaotic family, or is this a family which is very much together and not chaotic? And I'll talk about that in a moment, number one. Number two is this family an engaged family? So the family may not be chaotic, but what is the nature of the relationship between the mother and the father and between the children and the parents? And thirdly, which is particular to the Bali Tshuva community, which I think is a fascinating thing we should perhaps open up later for discussion, is the whole idea of community integration. What happens to your children? Can they become part and parcel of the community? Can they be absorbed into the day schools and absorbed into the fabric of the Orthodox Jewish community? Which is a specific challenge for children who are coming from homes of Bali Tshuva. Let's go back for a second. When I look at this case, you know, I don't have enough information to really analyze this, but this would be the process to which I would think. I mean, is this a chaotic family? Is this a family which, under any circumstances, under any place, would be defined as chaotic? Disorganized? Is there a lot of conflict in this family? What is the nature of the relationship between the father and the husband? What are these children seeing? Are they seeing constant conflict? And unlike the popular belief that children can tolerate constant conflict, they cannot tolerate constant conflict. So what is the child being exposed to in this home? And an interesting thing, and I brought this up at a Beis Yaakov convention a number of years ago, one of the issues in terms of creating the chaos in the family and amplifying the chaos in the family is, in fact, the size of the family. And this was borne out in the studies that Kahn and Polkowitz did, but I can tell you intuitively, right, having seen a lot of families over the years when they come to Sunnybrook, our meeting rooms are not big enough to meet the full family, because they're going to bring 15 kids and the grandchildren right into the room, and there are no textbooks to talk about that dynamic. And if you have a dysfunctional phenomenon which is taking place, that's going to be amplified exponentially if the family is large. And a child who has a specific need, i.e. a learning issue or a developmental issue, the chances of that child being overlooked right in a large family which is chaotic, right, it's going to be terrible. Now, that doesn't mean to say that there are not families, large frum families, Bali Tshuva families or otherwise, that are functioning. I'm just pointing out that if the family is already chaotic, and you multiply on top of that 10 children or 9 children, and then you take the economic stress, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, you are talking about chaos. Now, where do you put Judaism, Torah, mitzvah, and observance? Because you need to see this contextually. Because the relationship, as you refer to, it's not an issue of ideology, it's not an issue of some kind of philosophical epiphany that the 17-year-old has, right, about the Creator. But it's about the fabric and the dynamic in the home. and the relationship issues. Now, even if the family is not chaotic, how engaged are they? How engaged are they with the children? And think about our lifestyles, our collective lifestyles. And I speak about myself as well. I mean, none of us are exempt from this. First of all, our lifestyle has a lot of demands. Getting up in the morning and davening, learning Sitara, making a heck of a lot of money to pay for all the tuitions. It has a lot of demands. And how engaged am I with each and every one of my children in that process? Are we living a parallel existence or are we living a relationship existence? Do I have, I remember once, many years ago I spoke to my Rebbe, Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg, talking this whole issue of where I should send my kid to yeshiva. Should I send him out of town, in town, out of town? He said, do you have a shaykhus? Which means, do you have a connection? I said, you have a connection, whether it's a yeshiva connection with the yeshiva. No, I said, do you have a shaykhus? Well, what are you saying, Rebbe? Do you have a relationship with your child? What is the bond like with your child? You're talking about potentially sending him or her out of town? What is the relationship with a kid? Are you connected with his child? So the engagement is something that I would want to analyze, okay, in this family. What is the engagement? What's the communication? What's the relationship and the shaykhs, as Robert Weinberg said, that I have to my children? And lastly, which I think is particular to the Baal Tshuva community, is the idea of community integration. I mean, every child needs to be raised in a community. And they have peers. And they need to be accepted amongst their peers. And it needs to make sense. Because you cannot have integration if I'm running off to Acapulco, okay, and if I am having the, you know, all kinds of exposure within my home, and I'm reading all kinds of literature and exposing my children to all kinds of things. I'm not getting into what's kosher trait, just what's open and what's closed. And then think I'm going to send that child with long payas to a cheder. And that's going to make sense. How is that child going to integrate into the system? When the family, right, thinks that they're making a tremendous religious movement, right, by dedicating their child to be Kulei Torah and sending them off to a cheder, but the family's living a different kind of lifestyle. And how will this child be accepted there? Socially. And what about if the child is further behind in terms of their Limud Kodesh, and now you're integrating them into a system, and now a system that's a rit, that's Hebrew immersion, or a system that's in Yiddish, or a system that's even in English, but they don't have that kind of background? And what happens if you have a child who has learning disabilities, who has difficulties with expressive or receptive language issues, and now you're going to send him to a dual curriculum, and he's going to have issues with regards to his schooling? So all these things need to be taken into consideration and to analyze very carefully with a sensitive rav, right? With sensitive mother and father who are trying to understand what the dynamic here is in my home and how I can best, as a family, right, move forward. But those are the issues that need to be reflected on. It's not just a religious conviction and saying, oh, my child, you know, I've had a religious epiphany, my child, you know, will come onto line and must see it that way. There's something dysfunctional with a parent who takes that kind of attitude. Okay, Judaism and religious life is an enhancer, no question about it. And it's true, no question about it. But it's also true that we need to understand who we are as a family, what the needs are of each of my children, the stages of life that they're at, because there's a difference between a 10-year-old, a 15-year-old, and a 17-year-old in terms of how you're going to integrate them in the community. And take all those things into consideration with the sensitivity of a rav who has good guidance, and then move my children forward. But if you move it forward in a way which is not chaotic, if you move it forward in a way which is engaged, and if you move it forward in a way where there's an eye to integration, it makes sense, your chances of success are much greater. But if you do not take these things into consideration, and only see this as some kind of religious conviction or commitment, and I'm going to move these pieces here or there, then you're in for a lot of challenges, and you will not be successful.
much. When we put this together, Rabbi Rothman offered me the opportunity that I could comment on scenarios also. So I just want to briefly add one note from my own experience. Before moving to Toronto, I was a rabbi of a shul for 12 years, and I certainly saw cases like this. And I think maybe this goes a little bit into what Dr. Westreich was saying at the end. There's an issue of expectations. What is normal to expect? And I think that to a certain extent, it's less than reasonable for parents to believe that they can shift their 17-year-old child's identity, lifestyle, peer group, etc., because, to use your term, they had a religious epiphany. It's not a reasonable expectation. When parents raise their children in a certain lifestyle and they live it in an attractive way, it's reasonable to expect that the children, having experienced it as attractive, will try it out themselves and find meaning in it. If you change when the child is already a teenager, and here we're talking about a late teen, and say, and you're coming along for the ride, I don't know that that's something that's safe to expect. Instead, I would almost say that they should look at this child as though the child was a stranger. In other words, if there were a random 17-year-old who you encountered on the street and you were to walk over to him and say, listen, I'm now going to change the way you live your life. Now you are going to live your life eating kosher. Now you're going to not go to this type of entertainment. Now you're going to wear tzitzis. Now you're going to dot, dot, dot. If you say that to a random 17-year-old, you can't really have any expectation of success. And what the parents have done in this scenario, to a certain extent, by expecting that of the child, is what you're doing to the 17-year-old stranger. We have principles in halacha of how to rebuke, how to perform the mitzvah of tochacha, whom we approach, how we approach them. And I think that the parents in the scenario that we're describing should probably sit down with their rav and sit down with some svarim and learn about approaches and what might work and what might not work, what's acceptable, what's not acceptable, but be prepared for the idea that they may well have a 17-year-old who's at a very different place religiously in their home for some time to come. So that's the first scenario. Are there questions, points for discussion within that scenario first? Covered it? Yes?
I would like to jump about 4 or 5 years ahead. You're talking about the time about 70 years. The Romans are starting over 70, 71, 75. What is your opinion?
Well, I mean, when you understand the dynamic, I mean, essentially, what is adolescence? It's this, if you look at a view from Eric Erickson, you're looking at the struggle of individual being individual versus the separation. You're looking at the emergence of moving from a child to becoming an adult, right? That's the dynamic that's at play. That's the normal thing that's happening with your teenager. I'm going to get to your 22-year-old in a second. That's the normal thing that's happening with your teenager. How separate are they versus how connected are they? How do they find their individuality? And how are they part of the family? Right? And you need a lot of seichel to figure that out. To let a kid express himself, he might express himself to the right, to the left, to the center. You need a lot of seichel. If you try to smash that and don't appreciate that dynamic, you're going to have an explosion. Certainly with many children. Just developmentally, okay? Once somebody's moving to their 20s, even though, I mean, a lot of us have 20-year-olds, 25-year-olds, 35-year-olds living at home who are dependent upon us, you know, in a late in adolescence. But in reality, they really moved into an adult phase. So the dynamic, they're adults, 22, 24, 25, 26. So your level of influence, okay, and how you're going to deal with them needs to be structured in a way where you're looking at them much more like an adult than you're looking at a child. And it'd be very, very hard, I think, okay, to make shifts with your kid once they're that age. Again, if there is a relationship there, if there's a healthy dynamic that exists there, and you're moving into a Torah observant life, and your adult children can see what you're doing, you might influence them. You'll never influence them, by the way, if you do not have a relationship with them. You won't. In fact, it will become the currency of rebellion and rejection. If you do not have a relationship with your child, and he is angry at you, and you have not resolved the issues of separation and individuation, and you do not have this kind of proper adult-like relationship with your child, I'll trust you. You will go nowhere with him. Because as you confront him about religion, as with the child too, but with your adult child, he will not accept it. Because he doesn't accept you. It becomes the currency. So it's all in the relationship. In fact, the rabbi will tell you, when it comes to the work of Kirov, it's all in the relationship. When it comes to a teacher, yes, of course, there's content the teacher needs to make, but what makes a fantastic teacher is the relationship he's going to have with his students, or a rabbi, the relationship he's going to have with his congregants, and a father and a mother, the relationship he's going to have with his children.
Yeah, if I could add, I really have to say that when you're dealing with an adult, I mean, I know that when I was that age, it would have taken a lot for my father to try to tell me what to do. And I had already changed my entire lifestyle by the time I was in my early 20s. And had gone my own way, even though, and the reason that I was able to still go back and have a relationship with my father is because we had a relationship then. But the point being is that the only way that we're going to be able to influence our children when they're of those ages, and even of the age in this example, is by not pushing. Because there's absolutely no question, when they get to be this age, if you push, you do just that, you push them away. The only way we're going to get them at this point to even deal with the issues of Torah and issues of Judaism is by them seeing how we live and the happiness it brings us and the relationship we have with them despite it. And then, very often, it can open them up to experimentation and interest. But without that, it's really lost. It's really that idea. And even with it, it doesn't always work. But the idea being, it all relies again on the two of you, the relationships that we have with our children, and then they see us and want to emulate us because they see, this is the definition of a happy family. My father and my mother had a happy marriage. I want to be like them. A part of that was Torah. A part of that was Shabbos. I don't see that with other people. They're not having any meals together ever. But they're never going to get to that point unless we have that relationship. And even with it, it may not. But certainly without it, it won't.
So what we've seen on this question are the if I can just sum up in 10 seconds, are the importance of relationship, family context, and realistic expectations. There was a question over here.
You dwelled on how to adjust to the new situation for the volunteers. But it seems to me that for a lot of the children in the age ranges that you described, there's really a big issue about loss. The children have not made a choice to become yeshiva, to give up the lifestyle that they had, the friends they had, the school they had, the camp they had, the movies they had. And it's taking a lot away and replacing it with truth. You know, it's not such a good deal, it seems to me.
That's exactly the point. That's exactly the point. Because to a child, that our search for truth and our belief that we have found truth does not affect them. You can take religion out of the factor. You have to move to a new city. Right? You just have to move. Your job, you've been transferred in your job. Watch what happens with the children. The children don't want to leave their old school. The children don't want to leave their friends. The children don't want to leave the life they have in whatever place that it is. And we're forcing them to leave. It's the exact same idea, except this is not just short term. This is constant for them. They're still in the same city. They won't be going to the same school. They'll be associating with their friends, but they can't associate with them on weekends, and they can't associate with them in the restaurants, and it's just not going to work. So we need to try to work through those things by them seeing that we're happy. When they're teenagers, they may never come. But later on in life, if the relationship is good, they can look back at us and say, I'm going to get married. Now that I'm going to get married, I'd like to... the definition of marriage is like my parents. My parents were happy. My parents showed me this and this and this. And then religion is a part of my life. Then they may assume part of that. But unless that happens, then it'll simply be, as Dr. Westreich says, it's the currency. It's the issue. The religion becomes the issue itself. And they're not going to give in. Because then that means they've lost. And we don't want to make that into a contest.
Question in the back.
Like every Dr. Derrick kid, I was spending the evening surfing the internet. came onto Rabbi Tolchina's blog, which came out, how dangerous such a pastime is. So I know it's called Rebels and Trust, which is very good. I was reading, he actually posted, for a few that I follow his blog, he posted all of these scenarios. I sat and I wrote responses, and when I posted them, I suddenly saw the introduction, which said, this evening, we have a good program. So I got in the car and I drove them. But I was waiting to hear three very wise panelists use describe one word. That is respect. With your 17-year-old or your 15-year-old or your 10-year-old, particularly, you have to respect the child. Like Dr. Frederick, in my professional capacity, I see a lot of these kids. And there are two complaints that they have. One is, my parents did not respect my integrity. They didn't respect who I was, my personality. In fact, as Rabbi Rothman said, they grow up in a certain way. When the parents shift, the kids haven't chosen to shift. The more you're saying to the kids, the first thing you're saying to the kids is, you have to unlearn everything that we've been teaching you for the last 17 years. And all the lessons we've taught you about how you can behave and how we behave have suddenly changed. Well, it's very difficult. Young person to accept that, and you have to have, number one, respect for that young person as an individual, and the kid has to feel that their parents still want what is best for them, by the student's definition, not by the parent's definition, number one. Number two, the other hugely aggravating factor is the question of conformity, and the tolerance of non-conformity. The biggest sin in today's Orthodox world. And so often, you see students, young people, whose life has been thrown into chaos because whether it's at school or occasionally at home, there's no tolerance for their wish to be even slightly non-conformist. They want to wear a blue shirt instead of a white shirt. They want to wear this sort of shoe and not that sort of shoe. And those hugely, hugely, hugely aggravating factors. Since you frame the scenario in terms of how can we help a 17-year-old, I think that's the answer. And, go back to your blog and see how you post it.
Thank you very much for reading. Mission accomplished in posting it. Wants to respond to that?
Hi, I essentially agree with what you're saying. I was just using, different language to say that. But and I think you're right. I think that the issues are not just endogenous to the, for lack of a better term, Bali Tshuva community. It's broader. I think one of the things that we're struggling with in the community, and I don't think anybody has the monopoly of truth here. I've had the privilege of addressing both spectrums of the community, and what I'm referring to is the idea of censorship and being very, very close, very, very close, so to speak, to protect my child and close them off for the world, versus the other extreme, which is kind of very open and very engaging as an Orthodox Jew, but in the broader secular world. And I think this is really, I don't think this is a new debate. I think it's taken new forms in 2012. But this is what's happening within Orthodoxy. This, how much exposure and how much are we going to be closing off to the world? And both are fraught with lots of difficulties. Both are fraught with lots of difficulties. I really don't know where the monopoly of truth is, but I know that a guiding light is that it needs to contextually make sense within my family. And that's where you get all these weird aberrations. When you are mixed signaling your child, okay, and there are some intrinsic signals which don't make sense in our community, okay, but within the context of the family, when you are giving your kids different kinds of signaling in terms of what's really valuable and what's important, it's very, very confusing. And whatever you're going to adopt is not going to make sense unless it is really lived by the family in a thorough way with lots of integrity. But the community at large is struggling. And by the way, there's a lot, this shouldn't be an evening of Orthodox bashing or Bali Tshuva bashing, because in the end of the day, we're doing pretty good. I mean, we have brought a lot, I think this is an important point, we have brought a lot of issues a lot of issues are coming forth over the last 10 or 20 years. The issues of abuse, okay, the drug use, the disintegration of family, et cetera, et cetera. And the studies do not seem to indicate that these things exist anymore in the Orthodox community. We're talking about them more. People are getting a misperception, you know, that it's rampant and that there's all kinds of problems. We have, for so many years, suppressed talking about the subject, that people are just overwhelmed and bombarded with these ideas. But there are issues in the community. It is complex. The society we live in is complex. Our children are faced with all kinds of complexities. And I think we have been, I think our fault is that we've been slow, very slow on the uptake, okay, of dealing with a lot of the issues. And if you take a look at the literature, okay, it's not just in terms of how to prevent these things, but how in anticipation, early on, what are the seedlings that need to be in place for our children in the schools and for our families that are going to ensure that we're going to have healthy families. And we don't have, in this community, for instance, we don't have the proper kinds of resources. We are behind. We don't have the proper kinds of resources. And we're certainly not avant-garde in terms of dealing with the issues early on with our children. Now, there are some things that are just starting in the community, but it's late. And so if you have a child, there's lots of learning issues and lots of difficulties. I mean, these children, I'm going to get into my spiel because I can't believe what I see. I can't believe the kid could go through our system, okay? Through the entire system. And, you know, rabbis or teachers saying all kinds of things about a kid. I saw a child, one boy, came to my office at 19, rebuttish on him. He had Asperger's disorder. If you were a janitor, you would make the diagnosis. Now, where was this kid? He suffered for so many years in our system. Okay, as a behavioral problem, or as this or that, and they never dealt with this child. The whole entire trajectory of this child would have been changed had they been dealt with in elementary school or in kindergarten. So, to me, this is the problem in the community, that we need to get up ahead of the curve to understand how to deal with these things in their inception. Because once it's down the road and the child is so alienated, and so marginalized, it is very, very, very difficult to bring them back into the fold. I don't know if you're getting the idea, but I'm pretty passionate about this.
You know, if I could add, you know, to take scenarios of people who are perhaps not as extreme as even with learning disabilities and so forth, where we simply deal with eccentricities, with kids who are different. They don't conform. They don't fit in. As I said earlier, they're a square peg going into a round hole. The fact is that we as adults many of us have eccentricities. I love eccentricities. When I deal with people who have it, it brings me closer to them. I know I have them. And if I want to try to force my children to not have them and to put them into a black and white situation, I'm going to destroy them. Then it's just not going to work. And therefore, we need to be able to be tolerant of these things. Not only just be tolerant, but to openly allow it and to be respectful of them. You know, we all fail in it. We all have, you know, it happens to all of us. But the fact remains that the areas of my life where I'm eccentric, where I'm different, where I do things my way rather than like everyone else, right, I have to remember that, especially with a teenager, because they do everything different, right, that we have to allow that. And we have to allow for it. You know, it tells us that you know, Hashem judges a tzaddik like a hair's breadth. Right, that means that if a person is not a tzaddik, he gives them more openness. There's more than just a hair. Right, we have to do the same thing when we're dealing with an adolescent. We don't have to say, you know, is white shirt has long sleeves or has short sleeves? Is a white shirt is a blue shirt? Is he wearing a tie? He's not wearing a tie. Right, is he wearing black shoes or black sneakers? All of these things, right, they seem to be important. They're important when you're dealing with a child whose only issues are little tiny details. But very few children in the world today are like that. And therefore, it's certainly important for us to understand the differences, the individuality of the children, and to give them that opportunity to express it, even if it's not the way we want them to look. Because I can promise you that there's probably a few people in this room who look the way their parents wanted them to look when they were 16 and 17. I know I did.
Thank you. It's already about 10 after 9, so we're going to have three more questions. I feel like the time has flown by, but we'll have three more questions for tonight. Rabbi.
Rather than trying to make our children religious, should we just be trying to make our children happy?
The question was asked, should we be trying to make our children religious, or should we try to make them happy?
The only way you're going to, quote unquote, make your children religious is by making them happy. So that's how I'd answer that. I mean, again, I go back to the same fundamental point. It's about the relationship. It's about caring for your child, doing what your child needs, and the fact that he's not an object. He's not a chesishal mitzvah, right? It's not that I have this passionate obligation to shake this lulav, right, and or to move this child and to make him religious. The objective is to love my child, to have a relationship with my child, and everything else will flow from that. Yes, of course, as a dad, you know, I like to influence my kids a little bit, to think a little bit like I do. So along the ideas of religion as well, that'll be a natural flow. But it starts with a relationship. It comes the other way around. It's never going to happen.
Nothing more to say about that.
Yeah, sounds good. Okay. Question over here? Yes, please.
Can you comment on, I think I have trouble teasing out the issue of engagement in building the relationship, let's say with a teenager, and parenting, that I want to be engaged, I want to be supportive, and I want that love to be unconditional. And at the same time, I have to have, I'm just not saying just in Yiddish type, but just in life, I have to have standards.
Absolutely.
I have to have expectations. Sometimes I struggle. Let's say a child disses a Rebbe, you know, or doesn't want to do their studies or learn. Or so I have to ask myself, well, what would be my perspective if this was math class? But at the same time, I fear honing in on the learning and the davening and the Rebbe and the, because it brushes up very close to a rebellion against Yiddishkeit when my issue is a parenting issue.
Do you understand?
And I struggle. Like, an incident happened and he took something away and there was a lot of anger. And there's a feeling like maybe we should just give it back because we just want this close, loving relationship. And do you know what I'm saying? But I feel like, no, this is a parenting issue. Not everything is a Yiddish type. Comment on how to tease out the difference between those two.
Yeah, I think your approach is right. It is all about parenting issues, and engagement does not mean that I'm going to allow my child to do whatever he or she wants to do. I'm not advocating that there shouldn't be any discipline. It gets even more complicated because each child is a particular chemistry that exists between you and him or her. And each experience that a child has is particularly different. So there are general rules about parenting, but when you drill down to it, when you're dealing with a certain child is a certain kind of disposition, you need to be able to move your parenting in a way where you're going to understand how this kid operates. But you're never, ever going to advocate and give up being a parent. Not for the sake of Judaism, not for the sake of anything. Because you will not have an appropriate child if he doesn't know no. A child needs to know no. He needs to know yes. He needs to know. But one of the problems when it comes to some of the religious issues, especially, I think, you know, for the new Bali Tshuva family, where they really don't know, for instance, what is yes and what is no, and what is minhag, and what is midrabanan, what's midraisa, and where you can be meiko, and what's just a chumra, and what's just a crazy thing going on in the school. I think one of the disadvantages you're at, no, I'm serious, but I think one of the disadvantages you're at is that, you know, you want to apply the same principles to the religious issues as you do to anything else with your kid. You want to parent him. What's right and what's wrong. It's just that you don't know where the bottom of the pool is when it comes to some of the religious issues. That's one of your challenges. That's why you need a very good rav, okay, who's going to help guide you so you can know, I'm in 5 feet water, I'm in 3 feet water. And I feel for parents who are left in that kind of situation. Somebody who's been raised, you know, Orthodox and has a context. Well, this is how I grew up. This is what my mother did. This is what my father did. And they have a whole frame of reference. Even if they're not thorough in terms of understanding the details of the Mishneh Berurah. But they grew up with their mother and their father, right? They grew up with aunts and uncles. They saw a whole context and a whole situation. There's an intuitiveness, okay, to how they're going to raise their children religiously. If you haven't been raised with that as Balei Teshuva, you have that kind of struggle. And then you can end up inadvertently taking something which should not be an issue whatsoever. And if you're sincere, you're a good parent. You accentuate something which is a total shtus, but you're not really familiar with that. And that's why, you know, to have a rabbi and to have teachers in the school who are sensitive, who can help you and guide you along that way, it's so, so important. Because that's your handicap, really. You know? Even if you're the best parent, but the fact you don't know what's right and what's wrong. And then you get the other side, by the way, which is really interesting, which is your kid totally frums out on you. Because more religious than you. Okay? And then he comes home and he's tousling up your house and tousling up your kitchen and everything else. And you're feeling insecure. Well, you're feeling insecure because, you know, you're not quite sure. This is what you learned. You read, maybe Rabbi so-and-so said this, said this, Rabbi so-and-so said that. You know, to have that kind of level of confidence, I mean, it's something that you're constantly struggling with. To have a rav, okay, a teacher, a rabbitzin, who is really seichelik. Okay, and really understands the priorities to help guide you along the way. I think that's really, really critical.
If I would add, I'm not going to tell you something you don't know. We are our children's parents, not their friends. And the fact is, if we want to have a good relationship, they want us to be their parents, not their friends. And therefore, there are times when we have to say no, and there are times when we have to be difficult, and they anticipate it, and then in the long run, they appreciate it. It doesn't mean that we have to be, you know, the hanging judge, but we have to show a certain amount of discipline. We have to let the child understand that. Certainly, with your example that you mentioned about what I treat in my child who was chutzpahdik to the Rebbe, and then was chutzpahdik to the math teacher, what I do to treat them the same, you know, I hear that a lot. We do have, in our shul here, we have some people who are secular studies teachers in religious schools. And the stories they tell me that they come back with, like, they'd curl my hair if it wasn't already somewhat curly. It's unbelievable, the stuff that I hear, because the parents are confusing that. And they're not saying, you need to be respected, you need to respect people. You need to respect your teacher, not just your Rebbe. Certainly, it's more, you know, there's more to it with a Rebbe. There's the question of, you know, Torah and so forth. But nevertheless, it's a human being, Jewish, not Jewish. The person is in Tzelem Elohim. We need to show the respect to them. And therefore, when we do that to our children, and we draw a division between the secular studies and the religious studies as far as how they're treated and what seriousness we take with them, we're setting everything up for failure. Because the children are not going to distinguish between it, and they're just going to think my parents like them and want us to be respectful to them because they're part of our community. But these people, they don't care about, and that's not how you feel. And that's not how we feel. We're sending that wrong message.
Thank you. Last question. Yes.
Sherry. Was that Sherry?
Yeah. I see two hands. All right, we'll take both of those questions. Yeah.
I'm just wondering if you can comment on, with a lot of children who come out of the day school, like you're saying, lots of the damage, but definitely a lot of them are not inspired. So can you comment on what you do?
The question is about children who come out of our schools, not damaged, but not inspired either.
Yeah. Listen, I don't want to be, we have Mr. Shaviv here, I don't want to be too heavy on the schools. And I don't think it's all a school issue, okay? But it is complex. And I'm personally a very big believer in, yes, I think that children need a solid education and we must send them to excellent schools. But there's so many other things that need to happen with our children along the way to really give them a good sense of themselves and a really enhanced experience growing up as a youngster and as an adolescent. I mean, the camp experience, right, is so important. Informal education, Shabbatonim, and going back to my NCSY days. I mean, all these things are important. I think in general, you know, we are really dealing with a period of time, and I think it's global. It's just, not just in Toronto right here. I mean, you know, I just came back from Eretz Israel. You know, we're talking about the post-Zionist era. I mean, I grew up myself at a time, the Soviet Jewry, Israel. it was so exciting. It was so on the edge. It was so much. I met with people in Israel who made Aliyah, who made all kinds of sacrifices. And they're dealing with their from Israeli kids who are just like blasé about the whole thing. You know, could care less about it. And they're looking at the parents as they're being old-fashioned. We are in a long run right now. I mean, the excitement of the Bali Tshuva movement, the excitement of the Kollel movement, the excitement of Eretz Yisrael, the political issues in terms of Soviet Jewry and fighting. There's a lot of apathy and a lot of jadedness that's out there in the community, in the Jewish community at large and the Orthodox community in particular. We need to find inspiration. We need to find inspirational experiences for our kids. We need to feel inspired and renewed in our own learning and our own growth. Right? And we need to expose our children to that, to fight against that. Because I think that's really what the kids are just so jaded today. They are so jaded. I'm not promoting that contextually, I'm saying contextually. Is it camp? Is it Camp Aguda? Is it Moshava? I mean, whatever it is that makes sense for your family, okay, those are the things that you need to be doing for your child. You cannot rely on the school alone, okay, for the child to find that kind of inspiration. If a child in particular has learning issues, and, you know, like one kid told me, I saw a kid recently in the hospital, and he says, my life is perfect except for school. I said, what else? School and family. I said, what else? I mean, you're all 14. Like, what else do you have in your life except for school, family, and a few friends? I mean, it's a tremendous part of their lives. Tremendous part of their lives. So, you know, and that's one of the issues, too. And when you are studying Torah, or coming to Rabbi Roth and Shurim, or being involved with Eishet Torah, it's of a volitional nature. The bottom line is, we can talk all we want here today. The bottom line is, the kid will have a Gemara quiz. Okay, and he's in sixth grade, and I don't care what kind of family he comes from, okay, he doesn't want a quiz, and he probably prefer playing basketball than learning Gemara. And that's a challenge that all of us have as from parents, but we need to find the opportunities to inspire our kids and to give them space. And to fight against the apathy, and to fight against our own apathy, because they pick up on our own apathy as well.
And that's really, I think that last line is extremely important. The way that our children are inspired is by seeing us being inspired, by seeing us being excited about something novel, something new, about our talking about something, and also it's very important that we don't act one way, right, and then act a different way or say a different way, because they're going to see it. They see it every time. They never miss it. Right? And they may never say it, but they see it. And the reality is that the children, our children, our teenagers, our friends, they see that we're inspired, they become inspired by us. And therefore, if we let them share in that helps them immensely. If we don't, and we talk about how difficult it is to be Jewish, and we complain about how much money it costs, and it's all true, and it can be hard, and it is expensive, but the fact is, if that's all we talk about, that's all they're going to hear. And that is not going to be something that brings them closer. It's going to push them away from my lifestyle, because I don't want to do to my wife what my father did to his. And that she had so much difficulty, never had enough money for anything.
Right. And just to go back to a comment that I had made in introductory remarks at the start, I talked about Yoshua ben Gamla creating a system of schools 2,000 years ago when he saw that parents weren't able to impart the education that their children needed. That's in terms of book learning. That's in terms of being able to open up a text and read it and know what it says and perhaps know what halacha prescribes and so on. But you know, schools are extremely limited in terms of what they can provide, in terms of the inspiration that we're talking about, in terms of the experience that we're talking about. And there it does go back to the home life. The children who see something inspirational at home will say that's something we'd like to, or we hope they'll say, that's something we'd like to emulate when we grow up. But a lot of it really does come back to the parents in terms of the life experience that hopefully is attractive and inspirational and inspiring for the kids. I said there would be, I see more hands, but I did say the last
one. Well, one of them is Metexia. It's Rabbi Westrock's wife.
Oops. Okay, after this question.
Building block, what is
question is basically what was just said at the end. What are the ABCs of that good relationship with our children that we keep talking about as the building block?
Trying to figure it out. Look, I think these things were touched on from various people. There needs to be a kind of serenity in the home. Let's start there. So there needs to be a serenity in the home. There needs to be a serenity between husband and wife. Let's even before the child comes on board. We didn't talk about this dynamic, but when religion becomes the currency or the weapon between the husband and wife, then each child that comes along is going to become compounding interest in that very toxic dynamic that exists between the mother and father. So your marriage needs to be intact if you want to raise and have a good relationship with your children. And yeah. Well, I mean, as a single mom, and that's a very common thing today in our community, right? Your care and your love and your understanding of this child, okay, despite whatever has happened or unfolded, you know, in your marriage, you want to hang in there with your kid and understand him and validate him and honor him, and at the same time understand who they are and direct them in accordance to understanding this child. It's very hard to give generic expectations for children. I think understanding the child is very, very important. What are they struggling with? What do they want? What are their needs? It's very important to understand the kid. Yeah, that's what I would say.
Yeah, there really isn't much more to add. If we put together the idea that, you know, that we respect our child and we speak to them about their interests, about our interests, and so forth, and we build on that relationship with the fact that we respect them and everything isn't always about religion, then we can work on building that relationship. But it is true that they see how we react with other people, how we are with the other siblings, with other people in our lives, and they will emulate that themselves, and they'll want to be similar to that. And our relationship with them has to be one of, as much as we can, with trust and respect within the boundaries of parent-child rather than of two friends.
When I talk about what's involved in the relationship with one's children, to me it comes back to the word relationship. The whole idea is that one relates to the other, that the child should understand that what she does impacts on you, and that you understand that what you do impacts on the child. When the child understands that they matter, when the child understands that you see him, her, for who they are, and that what they do is going to be critical in your own life and in your own happiness, that, to me, is the building block. Not to the exclusion of anything else that was said, I think it goes along with it. Thank you very much for coming out. I want to thank our panelists for an incredible God willing, there will be a minion for Marv here in a few minutes.